And thank you for joining us on KVCR for KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, welcoming Tim Flores to talk about Kitty Hawk, the band, and a new release from this defunct group. As we go into the conversation, a bit of music from their first release from 1980. If you go looking for it, it's the self-titled release. Kitty Hawk, 40 years late, but right on time. This is a great statement, sort of poetic, definitely a great marketing or branding statement. Okay, this is at the bottom of the liner notes for this disc, which gives a touch of history of the band. We'll address the history sort of bit by bit and have songs from the new album and a bit from older releases as well, interwoven there. But going into it, how did you end up producing this body of work? This is a transition from fan in the 80s to let's make this thing happen.
Wow.
Well, in the 2000s.
How much time do you have? Okay. So the best way to start the story, let's put ourselves back in the early 1980s.
Okay.
Club scene here in Southern California, and it just wasn't the Los Angeles club scene. It was everything from Huntington Beach all the way going up to Santa Monica. There were a tremendous amount of clubs. You could go to just about two or three clubs a weekend and see a great band. As a matter of fact, the newspapers used to have a full two or three pages, and I don't know, they were probably two-inch ads showing each band playing in each location.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, you would look through there and see what was going on. For literally a few dollars to get in, two drink minimum, and you got yourself a meal and a really good show. One of the times, Kitty Hawk is playing, and it is probably one of the most unique bands to this day, as far as instrumentation, as far as writing, as far as performance. There was nothing like them. And there still isn't to this day, as far as I'm concerned. Quite unique.
And you didn't know them before that night? You just happened to be there.
Didn't know that.
Okay.
Didn't know that. Walked
in. Oh,
cool. Paul and Daniel were playing these instruments, and it turned out to be a Chapman stick. And then you get Richard Elliott playing tenor sax, soprano sax, and something called a Lyricon. We're blown away. We've never seen anything like this. I mean, this is something that's so unique, so I guess it felt technically advanced, even though the stick is still a stringed instrument that you tap on. You should go look up the Chapman stick online just to see what it looks like. But to give you a description, it's a 10-stringed instrument that's tuned in fifth on one side and tuned in fourth on the other. And it has the range of a cello. It is quite diverse and plugged through certain effects. You can really, really get a tremendously large sound just from one stick player. It's actually larger than a regular guitar. Yeah. Just think of it as like a board. Like, that's the reason why he called it a stick.
The board.
Right. It's a stick. Mr. Chapman, who invented the stick, called it the stick, and it actually looks like a stick. It's approximately four, and there's a longboard version, which is like five and a half feet.
Oh, wow.
And you literally tap, you press down on the strings. It's called a press board. And you press on to the fretboard, and that's what actually makes the sound. So you don't actually have to strum it. You can actually just press down on the fret, and that's what actually gets the response.
This next one was written by Daniel. It's called Kitty Hawk. We thought it'd be a good one to end with.
These were the early development of the Chapman stick. So they were the first ones that were coming out. And there's different variations that have gone through development. But this was back in the day when these things were first coming out.
Just outside of Laurel Canyon, right?
Yeah. So Daniel Bortz came here. He was a cello player from Phoenix, Arizona. And he sees an ad in a newspaper. And it says, tune like a guitar and cello, but plays like a piano. And he goes, well, I can do that. Let's see. So he looks up the address, and it's literally like half a mile away from where he was living at the time. And he's just cool. Like, you got to be kidding. He goes, okay. So he goes down to Emmett Chapman's place where he's making these by hand. And one of the people that's making these things, helping him make them, is Paul Edwards. But he goes in there, and he decides he's going to buy one. It develops a buzz. He calls him. He says, hey, you know, can you fix this? And he goes, yeah, bring it in. So he brings it in. Emma Chapman plays around with it, does a lot of stuff, and says, hey, you know, I'll tell you what. Let me just get you another one. Take this stick. Let me know how you feel with this one, and I'm going to fix this one up or whatever. That's how Daniel Bortz finds the Chapman stick. But the most amazing part about that particular story.
Yes.
He starts playing the new Chapman stick that Emmett had given to him.
Oh, that's where the riff, this
right,
this
so
riff.
He okay, has okay. this riff that he's been practicing. Paul Edwards is downstairs, and he hears this riff and goes, that's not Emmett playing, that's mm-hmm. somebody else playing. So he goes up to investigate, and he meets Daniel Bortz. They start to talking, and Paul liked the riff. He says, well, what's the name of the riff? Yeah. He says, it's called Kitty Hawk. He says, you got to be kidding. None. He goes, no, it's called Kitty Hawk. That's the name of the riff. He goes, why did you name it Kitty Hawk? He said, because it was kind of like the first flight with this brand new instrument that's new and unique. It has all these things.
But Paul just happened to have a briefcase with him.
So Paul says, wait a minute.
His eyes went wide.
Yeah, his eyes went wide. And he goes, you realize that I am a descendant of the Wright brothers. And of course, Daniel's like,
Yeah.
Sure, man. Whatever trips your trigger, that's great by me. But he goes, no, seriously. And he goes back, gets his briefcase, opens it up, and pulls out a piece of the sailcloth from the original Wright Brothers flyer. And he's like, wow. So this was kind of like, this is too good. So they started to hang out, and they started to write music. They started to do this whole thing. And now those were the two founders who started Kitty Hawk.
So then it wasn't like a couple of guys, you know, they decided they'd grow their hair long, pick up a six string, hey, let's get a band going, man. There was an attraction, the same type of music. Paul Edwards described as a singer turned stick obsessive.
Yeah.
That's just funny and accurate at the same time. So these guys just started hanging together because they were doing the same type of thing. And at some point there had to have been a conversation to even get a band going, which would then lead them off to get Richard and Michael. Anything about this time period where it went from we're making cool sounds together to we should do this on stage, man?
Yeah, the first band, I think it was about 1977. It really didn't turn into something till a few years later. Paul was helping develop with the stick. Paul was actually pretty active in making the stick and actually giving lessons to people who were buying them, you know, and so on and so forth. He was kind of his main job at the time.
Okay, the stick man.
Yeah,
okay.
And then Daniel, of course, because they both owned sticks and they were both into the stick. Like I said, they were writing and they would play clubs and stuff. But Daniel said one time, he goes, you know, what we need is a drummer and a sax player. And, you know, we that's it. We could have a band. You know, this just work out really well. So I guess they tried a variety of different musicians just on the fly, just to see who was going to fit in, who didn't. And from what I understand, there were a couple of drummers that they liked. One drummer in particular they really liked, and he subbed in for the drummer for Elton John.
Okay.
And said, guys, well, I'm out of here for a month. And they're like, well, wait a minute. We're going to start lining up jobs and stuff. You know, what are you doing? And he's like, I have an opportunity to play with Elton John, which is fine as a stand-in. You know, good stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He takes off. And so they're great. Now what do we do? Somehow they get a hold of Michael Jochum. Now, Michael Jochum was pretty young at the time, maybe early 20s.
Okay.
Brand new face, brand new drummer, but had such great chops that they looked at each other and said, this guy's it. We got to have this guy. He's that good of a drummer. Just a natural drummer. I've seen him play hundreds of times. His natural timing, his natural stamina, I mean, just coming out there and not slowing down and keeping that time so hard, it really is quite the talent. So they asked him, do you know anybody else? And I believe that it was Michael who said, well, you know, there's a guy named Richard.
Okay.
And he's playing around with these instruments and such. Why don't you have him come in? So that was kind of the nucleus that really was Kitty Hawk for the longest time. And Richard at the time, I believe he was probably about 19.
Oh, gosh, wow.
I mean, really young.
Really young.
And the one thing is that I remember seeing them, and I've worked with a lot of sax players. The one thing I can tell you is that Richard's intonation is about as perfect as you can get for playing saxophone.
Okay.
Very difficult. He played it on a Mark VI for quite a while. People realize that, well, the Mark VI is a great saxophone, yeah, but it's also pretty squirrely. In order to keep it in tune, in order to have not only right intonation, but to have it speak correctly, it was like he was born with this. You know,
beautiful.
It was just, it's absolutely amazing. Daniel's told me more than once that he could hear two notes and go, that's Richard.
One of those guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Richard. Then you put in the Lyricon. Now, what people don't realize is that these days they're referred to as iwis, which is...
Oh, that's the same thing?
Not quite.
Initially, it looks like a clarinet dressed up as a knight in shining armor.
Right.
It's kind of this... my kind of thing at the end of it, but I didn't know that these were the same thing, or well, I guess the same development or iteration.
Yeah,
or
right
something.
Now they're referred to as iwis, which stands for electronic wind instrument.
Yeah.
Back then, this was the first one that ever came out. It was called the Lyricon.
Okay, okay.
It's something like an analog instrument that's connected to a synthesizer, and the pickups get to the synthesizer, and then from there you can adjust it and make a variety of different sounds and textures and things like that. There still isn't anything like it, as far as I'm concerned. It really was quite unique.
I read it's one of what he had, anyway, or if this is still the case today, but one of fewer than 200 that had been produced, even?
I wouldn't doubt it, yeah. Tom Scott was the first one to get one.
Of course, Tom, yeah.
He was the first one to get one. Richard came very close. I'm not sure how Richard got it. I haven't spoken to him about that. But one of the craziest things about these instruments is that they were pretty squirrely. You know, they would go out of tune a lot, they would break down a lot, but Richard was so good at learning to cover his tracks on stage that if something did go wrong, he would jump in there, twist a few knobs or whatever, or adjust things, and then off they would go running.
Oh, beautiful. So we've got a fretted guitar and then the stick. I keep calling it a stick. I don't know if people out there would prefer it's a Chapman stick.
No, actually, believe it or not, Emmett wanted it to be the stick.
Okay, okay.
Period. Simply. But I think us people out there wanted to identify it as the Chapman stick,
okay.
And so we just put it out there. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, so people see this on its PBS special, and it's just amazing the type of sounds that are coming from this. Oh, also on Big City, we do get vocals. Was it Paul or Daniel?
Yeah, it's Paul who does all the vocals.
Right.
Yeah, Paul does all the vocals. Going back to Big City came out originally on their first album,
yes.
Which they were first signed on EMI. And it's just Kitty Hawk, Kitty Hawk. It's the namesake. They had a PBS special, turned out to be a big thing. And they were slowly but surely becoming the it band to go see in Southern California in the clubs. They would pack them in to the point where you thought to yourself these days, you know, why didn't they shut them down? You know,
hoping the fire marshal wasn't
there. The fire marshal wasn't there that night, you know, that type of a thing.
Praying. Okay.
And very funny, because I did talk to Jeff Lorber one time about that.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And he goes, well, you know what happened at a couple of those venues, right? And I said, what? They burnt down. I was like, oh, great. You know, thanks for telling me.
There's another Jeff Lorber fusion. That's
another
stuff that people can go check out.
Right. Well, the thing is, they actually opened up for Jeff Lorber as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they toured with Jeff. So that's how the conversation started. But getting back to this first album, it was really quite the amazing album. And then they had the PBS special that was called First Flight. And that really gave them a big push. Also, they got a good write-up in Guitar Magazine.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Tim Flores, producer and main spearhead behind a fantastic new release comprised of older material. The CD is Kitty Hawk, Reclaimed Bootlegs.
So they became slowly but surely the band to go see. And I would go follow them and talk to them. I was a fan, basically how it started the whole thing. And I would always go talk to Daniel and Richard, who were sitting at the bar. And of course, they're like, yeah, you know, leave me alone, kid, you know, whatever. So they would say, well, listen, you know, Paul's back in the green room. Why don't you go talk to him?
They were just getting rid of you.
They're getting rid of me. They're getting rid of me because I was... They wanted to talk to other people besides me. Let's put it that way. You know, because they were musicians. You know, they were the hot musicians at the time. So... So they go talk to Paul in the green room. Well, you have to understand, in these clubs back in the day, there weren't a green room. It was like a curtain or a room where they kept the chemicals to clean, you know, the bath. Right. I mean, it was it wasn't a green room. It was a whatever back there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would go back and I would talk to Paul. And this went on for years. And slowly but surely, when they dissolved and they had a few albums and, you know, things just didn't quite work out, kind of went to the wayside. But then go all the way to just right after the pandemic. And I haven't heard from a lot of musicians, and I'm kind of worried about them. I knew that the big acts were to be fine. But the people behind the shelves, playing horn or the backup singers or whatever, you know, what was going to happen to them? So I started reaching out to people. I reached out to Paul, and he friended me on Facebook. So I'm sitting back one night, can't sleep, pour myself a good cocktail, and start fluttering through my phone, which most people do these days.
Yeah.
And sure enough, Paul's online on Facebook. And I said, hey, you know, haven't heard from you. How's it going? So forth, so forth. We start messaging each other back and forth. And he stops, and he actually FaceTimes me, which, you know, for if you don't know, it's he's video calling me.
People saw this on the Jetsons.
Yeah, right. Dick Tracy on the watch, right?
The shoe phone.
The shoe phone. So we had that first conversation, and then a few days later, he comes back to me. He says, I'm watching what you've been doing. We need your help. We lost the name. We lost the catalog. It's confusing. It's out there, but we're not getting into residuals. We've lost recordings, all these things. The biggest concern at the time was just getting their name back and their catalog back. What we were able to do was secure their catalog through the streaming services. And one of the reasons why we had to recover that is because somebody decided they were going to take the name Katie Hawk. They trademarked it for a bit. I watched it. And then sooner or later, they stopped paying the bills. And I looked it up, and sure enough, it was reported as quote-unquote dead, which means it's available. And we've been going after it ever since. But it also gave us the opportunity to go to the streaming services also and say, look, we're the original Kitty Hawk. This is our catalog, being number one, Kitty Hawk, the first album, second album, Race for the Oasis, and the third album, Fanfare. And that's kind of the core of the catalog.
Okay.
But that was the original group with Paul Edwards, Daniel Bortz, Richard Elliott, and Michael Jochum. That really was the catalog right there.
Gotcha. Interestingly, when I was checking out Big City, I was on YouTube, and I wasn't on the Kitty Hawk topic page. And so afterward, it went to Frank Zappa performing Apostrophe, the tune, I should say, not the album. And I don't know if it was the algorithm or my watch history, but it was the perfect fit. I mean, this was some of the best in early 70s jazz fusion coming from Frank, but back to Kitty Hawk. There is something about that. Talk to me about this statement, the original jazz fusion group. You're going to be faced with this, I think, in every interview you do. The original jazz fusion group, this sets aside unknowns like Weather Report, Return to Forever, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters, Thrust era, and all of these really stemming from Miles and the era of Silent Way and Bitches Brew and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so maybe not then the original jazz fusion group, but rather the jazz fusion group, which had something very original going for it.
Yeah, okay. And I totally understand where you're coming from on that. Here was what I wanted to do.
Okay.
There were, as to today, probably about four different Kitty Hawks out there.
Oh, so this is the original.
So this is the original jazz fusion group that was called Kitty Hawk.
Okay, okay.
So I could have rephrased that, but it needed to fit on the album cover. So
yeah. And more people are going to remember it as such. Anyone worth their salt or has any bit of knowledge of this era, this type of jazz, they'll be coming after you with that one.
Well, which I greatly appreciate. I mean, I really do, because Alan Parsons had a point. Somebody said to him, well, your progressive rock, we really like that progressive rock. And he thought, well, we're more pop, right? You know? And then they started comparing him to other progressive rock groups.
Like Yes or something.
Yes, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Okay, sure.
And so he just went back and went, okay, if you want to put me in with that group of great musicians, great, I'll take it.
Mm.
So as far as I'm concerned, if I put the statement out there, the original jazz fusion group, and you go, what about Weather Report? I'll be like, great, if I could be part of that group of musicians and catalog of music, fantastic.
Sure, yeah, lump me in with that. That's fine.
Yeah, it's fine by me.
Okay, great. Okay, well, I had to ask about that, and certainly that's not saying, wait a minute, Tim. I mean, you know your history, so it's like, yeah. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Tim Flores for this edition of KVCR. It's talking about a new release, of some older music. The CD is Kitty Hawk, Reclaimed Bootlegs. Tim, the second track on here, called Never Once, this is one with lyrics, and I often wonder this anyway, but especially with a band with so much instrumental work, whether this was a set of words which needed music to make it work, you know, to serve as the vehicle, or if it was a great jam, which someone thought that perhaps, okay, this needs a vocal section here. Do you know which way it came
about? You know, I'm not sure if it was the chicken or the egg.
Okay.
But
okay.
I can tell you this. When the writing was done, Daniel and Paul, the way they did it was more like a jam.
So they would
come up with a riff. What if we did this? And they worked on the writing together, with an exception of very few. Let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
I got together with Kitty Hawk trying to get their catalog back, which we're able to do. And I am traveling for work, and Paul happens to live in Canada. So I said, well, Paul, since I'm going up that way to Seattle, why don't I just keep going over the border, and I'll talk to you about what we've been doing, show you where we've got the catalog. So we had dinner. We're driving back from dinner, and he turns to me and he says, well, how do we get on those big playlists? How do we get on the ones where millions of people are listening? I said, well, the only way you can do that is you have to have brand new material, and you have to go to the editors of Spotify and say, this is what I've got. We feel it fits into this genre. And if the editors give it a thumb up, then you put them on that particular playlist. But if they don't, it's no loss. You're still on Spotify. But it's got to be brand new material. And so he goes, oh, shucks. And there goes that one. And I said, well, here's the question for you, Paul. You guys were probably one of the best live bands I've ever heard. Did the label record you live? And he said, well, we've talked and we talked and we talked about it, but nothing ever happened. And I said, well, that's a shame, because that would have been something really special. A professional recording of you guys playing live. That would have been something just amazing. And he goes, yeah, he goes, but there are these Kitty Hawk nuts. They would record our concerts and then send them to us. He goes, we'd get stuff all the time. We get cassette recorders or a reel-to-reel.
Reels. Getting a reel in the mail.
You know, not even that. No, they'd just go backstage and hand to him. Here's this, you know, whatever. And I said, you got to be kidding. He goes, oh, no. He goes, there's one guy. He's got a whole collection. I said, okay, here's the deal, guys. Anything you have that's live, I need you to send it to me. Anything. I don't care what it is. And to be perfectly honest with you, everything that we got is considered to be a quote-unquote bootleg. It's everything from a small tape recorder in some guy's pocket at the Roxy to a quarter-inch reel-to-reel thrown on the stage with a jacket over it. Some guy bribed the sound guy to plug in a cassette recorder to the soundboard. There's a VHS tape. I would say 98% of what we got was absolutely untouchable. We just couldn't do anything with it. We went through a tremendous amount of material, and one of the places that we were able to take material from was an old CD that had been kicked around so long that it was completely unplayable. And I have to give Randy Strom a lot of credit for this one, because he's actually given the credit as the person who's been able to extract these files. He used dish soap and did something about rubbing the disc to the point where it was actually able to extract and rip music off.
I've heard of people using toothpaste and filling in the gaps. It's just this weird sort of stuff. Yeah.
Here's another thing I didn't know about. You can bake tape. You get cassette recorders that stick. Apparently, you get it to a certain temperature, you spin it around, and it stops sticking.
Yeah. I've known about this for, I think, 30 years or so, but I've yet to stick anything into the oven. I don't know if it's on broil or what. So
yeah, some of the guys that I was hanging around with while we were doing this, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, that's easy. Just pop it in there at 100 and what? I'm like, if this is the only copy we have, let's just keep moving on. I'm like, no, we'll get something off of it. That's where the process started. The guys in Kitty Hawk were like, can't be done. It's going to sound too terrible. We're going to look like fools. It's not going to sound good. Pulled in a couple of engineers. They said the same thing. Nah, can't be done. It's too far gone. And I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And Daniel came to me one day and said, you know, man, you're a dog with a bone. You really think you're going to get this done? I said, yeah, I think we're going to be able to get this done. It's not going to be easy, but we also have to take time to have technology catch up with us to make it affordable. And we just kept on it. At the very beginning, I pushed an engineer to the point where I said, well, you know, you need to make these changes. And he said, would you kid me? I've got hours. I said, no, but it can be better. Let's do this. Let's try that. I thought the guy was going to throw something at me. So I talked to Paul, and he goes, well, how did it sound when you made the changes? I said, it sounded better. He says, well, you know how to duck, don't you? I said, yeah. That was at the moment that I realized this is something different than I've ever done before.
Oh, sure.
This is a whole new, brand new thing. When we finally got through all these tracks, we got a group of them together, and I went through there and I said, okay, we can do Big City. I said, that's savable. I know it is. I heard Never Once, and there's something that's very unique about this particular version of Never Once on the bootleg album that is not anywhere else. Paul comes in with a different intro to the song that's on the album. Then he goes into the regular song and sings the song. And I thought, I've never heard it before. I can't find another version of this. Okay. It's a piece of history that we're never going to find.
Oh, right. It just happened that night.
Let's do that.
For this edition of KVC Arts, it's been conversation with Tim Flores, speaking primarily about a new release of older material, painstakingly and thankfully repaired and released as Kitty Hawk, Reclaimed Bootlegs. More at kittyhawkgroup.com. Also, timfloresproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Tim Flores and all the members of Kitty Hawk. And more with Tim on the next KVC Arts, exploring this fantastic new release. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Jessica Greenwell, Tony Lopez, and Shireen Awad. Many past shows can be found through Spotify, iTunes, NPR One, or many other podcast sites, and more still at kvcr.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.